Good evening. Welcome everyone to the University of Melbourne. My name's Margaret Scheel and I'm the Provost here at the University, and it's my very great pleasure to introduce tonight's lecture. I bring with me apologies from the Vice-Chancellor, who's en route to South America as part of an important engagement over there, but I know he very much would have liked to be here this evening. I also begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of this land, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, and on behalf of the University and all those present, pay my respect to their elders past and present. One of the great pleasures of my role, as I frequently reflect on, is that having broad responsibility for the library, because Philip and the library always brings me new opportunities and events to be part of. And I've reflected to the library staff when I first had the opportunity to meet with them as a group that my interest in libraries started with my father taking me to the library at a very young age, and in fact it's one of my earliest memories. The other legacy that I have from my father is that we had one of those households that where the television never moved off the public broadcaster. So while all my friends were watching Gilligan's Island or I Dream of Jeannie, I was watching some television show that was probably sourced from the BBC. And another very early memory, it was watching a series of programs or based around the Tudors. So there was a series based around Henry VIII. I think Keith Michelle was the star, and another one that went on to do Elizabeth I. And that started what became a fascination of a good part of my childhood with royal history. So bringing those two interests together is a wonderful opportunity tonight. And it's always been, I know, some bemusement to friends in the UK when I would be staying with them and they say, where would you like to go? And being an Australian of Irish convict heritage, I'd say, I'd really like to go up to that royal palace up the road and explore that fascination with history. So I'm very much looking forward to joining those two interests tonight in today's in this evening's lecture, and the fact the size of this audience means that I'm not alone in some of that fascination. So Oliver Everett and your wife Diana Jarvis Reid, colleagues and guests, it's a great pleasure to welcome you here to the University of Melbourne and joining us for tonight's lecture by our distinguished visitor, the Librarian Emeritus. He is a former librarian of the Royal Library of Windsor and assistant keeper of the Royal Archives, a position he held for many years until 2002, and as I've indicated, now holds the title Librarian Emeritus. His extraordinary career began with student days at Cambridge University and later the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University in Massachusetts. And we were just reflecting on his early time at Cambridge as a biochemist, and I pointed out that the new Pope has actually started life as a chemist, as did I, so we're all in good company. And obviously before his work as a librarian, Oliver served in the British Diplomatic Service in India and Spain. He was Assistant Private Secretary to the Prince of Wales and later Private Secretary to Diana, Princess of Wales. As librarian of the Royal Library, Mr. Everett has written extensively on its extraordinary collection, gathered over centuries and comprising a vast array of all forms of art and historical artefacts. He comes to us with a reputation as a passionate and engaged speaker, who's inspired by the desire to share the extraordinary riches of the Royal Collection. And on his current Australian visit, he has made a powerful impact on audiences around the country, and he tells me that this is his 17th lecture in this tour. So we are indeed very grateful that you've maintained your stamina and are joining us tonight. We really value here the University of Melbourne values this ongoing connection. This is not his first visit here, and we're delighted that this relationship is continuing, and it's a great pleasure to welcome you to speak at the event tonight. Oliver, thank you.
Thank you, Margaret, very much, and thank you for having us back. I might just say I mentioned something at the beginning to explain one or two of my eccentricities. I do like to keep the light on you a bit because I do, I like to see that you're still there. And also, I do ask a lot of questions, so do be on your toes. I'm sure you're extremely well informed, but don't be shy. Do answer the... Anyway, I might start by saying, I'm going to be talking about treasures and curiosities from the Royal Library at Windsor Castle. And I'd like to answer one or two general questions that I have asked. First one is, how does the Queen use the library? I often ask that, and some people think, for example, does she borrow books from the library? Does she get overdrawn? Is she fined? And the answer to that is no, because the Queen has her own collection of private books at each royal residence. And when I got to Windsor in 1983, I asked my predecessor exactly that question, how does the Queen use the library? And somewhat to my surprise, my predecessor said, in a word, as a cabaret. And I said, that needs explanation. This is an important library. Anyway, he said, this is the explanation. Some of you may know that the Queen uses Windsor Castle a lot, but she lives at Windsor Castle for the entire month of April each year. During that month, she always gives two or three dinner parties, and after every one of those dinner parties, she brings her guests to the Royal Library, where we have put out a special exhibition for all her guests. By a special exhibition, I mean that we in the library would get the guest list about 6 weeks before the dinner. My colleagues and I in the Royal Library and Royal Archives would select specific items for each guest, which made it very personal to them. In fact, my predecessor said to me that one of the advantages of this system is that it gave the guests something to mention in their thank you letters to the Queen. It's a small point, but an important one. And so what I'm going to do for you this evening, very briefly, is to give you that personal tour of the Royal Library that the Queen gives to her guests after those dinner parties. And this is, in fact, quite a privilege because the Royal Library is not open to the general public. Now, before I hear protests, which is a valid reaction, the answer is that the library is very much open to scholars and to specialist groups. And also, first question, by the way, how many of you have been to Windsor Castle? More than one, I hope. Hooray, excellent, very good indeed. You may remember there's something called Queen Mary's Doll's House. Yes, by the way, I do accept a nod as an answer to a question sometimes, as long as it's not sleep. The Queen Mary's Doll's House, some of you have heard of it. It's an amazing thing. Just next to Queen Mary's Doll's House, there is a small gallery at Windsor Castle, which is entirely devoted to treasures from the Royal Library. So that is always on public display. Also, of course, I'm sure that you're all good on websites and the internet. If you go, just put Royal Collection into your Google, up comes thousands of images, including many thousands from the Royal Library. So it's open in that respect as well. Now, another basic question that I'm often asked, when was the library at Windsor Castle established? And the short answer to that is 1833. Now, I'm sure some of you may immediately start thinking, wasn't Windsor Castle built a little before 1833? You were right, it was built from the 1080s by King William the Conqueror. And so the next question possibly creeps into your mind, does that mean to say that between 1080 and 1833, no monarch read a book? That's a valid question, but anyway, the answer to that question is that the Royal Library at Windsor Castle is in fact the third Royal Library to have existed. I'll very quickly mention the first two. The first one was established by King Edward IV in the 1470s, not at Windsor Castle, in London, at Whitehall Palace. That library accumulated over the years until, in 1757, when King George II was on the throne, he decided to give the whole of that library to the British Museum, which has just been created. And so that was the first library come and gone. 3 years after that, in 1760, King George III comes to the throne, and he, as many of you may know, was a great bibliophile, and he established the second Royal Library, again, not at Windsor Castle, but in this occasion at a place called Buckingham House, which was the predecessor of Buckingham Palace. And so that library accumulated during his reign. It was a big one. It was 65,000 volumes by the time he died in 1820. But sadly, after he died, his son, George IV, came to the throne, decided to convert Buckingham House into Buckingham Palace, and he therefore got rid of almost his entire father's library. He gave it to the British Museum. So that was the second Royal Library gone to the British Museum, which meant that there was no Royal Library. So we go on to 1830, when King George IV dies. The next king, his brother, King William IV, who is not a big bibliophile, but he decides there should be a Royal Library and that it should be at Windsor Castle. And so it was he who, in 1832, walked round Windsor Castle with an architect called Sir Geoffrey Wyatville and decided where to put the new library. And here we have Windsor Castle. This, by the way, is the east front of the castle. You can see the River Thames there going past just here. And so they decided to put it actually on the north front. Now, the north front, that is called the North Terrace along here. That's the North Terrace. And so the library is going to be under this, just under that pointer. And let's just see a plan of the castle. So there is that. We were looking at the east front over here. And that is the North Terrace along here, with a round tower we saw in the middle, obviously. Where they put the library was in these rooms from here to here, that little group of rooms just there. And I'm going to take you inside those rooms. Just before I do so, however, just to mention that when the Queen gives those dinner parties at Windsor Castle, she gives them in a dining room which is on the northeast corner, just here. And after dinner, she walks with her guests through the state apartments and in a door just there. And I'm going to show you that door in a second. Just before we do that, however, I'd like to show you the outside of the library. Let's stand on the terrace just here and look due east along the North Terrace. And do you see that tower? We're going to see that tower. So let's just have a look at that. There we are. So this is what's called the North Terrace. That's the tower I was talking about. So we're looking due east. You can just see the River Thames, which is going past here. And if you've got really good eyes, you should just be able to... Can you just see Heathrow Airport just there? Well, possibly not. OK, well, but you would do. We're looking due east towards London, and so that is towards Heathrow Airport. But this picture, I'm afraid, was in about 1765, so anyway, it's a bit early. But anyway, this is by one of the best watercolour artists in Britain in the 18th century. I sometimes get the answer. It's rather eccentric. Have any of you been to a place called Hamilton in Australia? There is a gallery there, and inside there are lots of watercolours by... Thank you very much. I can rely on audiences. Thank you very much. It was by somebody called Paul Sandby, and he had a brother called Thomas, and between them, they produced a huge number of wonderful watercolours of the Windsor Castle, not least because they lived there. Thomas had a job there. So this is by Paul Sandby. What we're going to do now is we're going to jump into that tower here and have our backs towards that window. And what it looks like is that. So you can see the tower. This is that tower structure here. We're looking due east again, down the first room of the Royal Library. This, by the way, is a watercolour from 1848 by a watercolour artist called Joseph Nash, who was employed by Queen Victoria a great deal. And in fact, we have Queen Victoria in this picture. That is Queen Victoria there. That's Prince Albert there. And this man with his back to us here is actually one of my predecessors, a gentleman called John Glover. Actually, there's another person called Glover who couldn't be here this evening, a great friend of mine. But anyway, that is John Glover, and he was the librarian of the day. And I don't know if any of you know a little bit about Prince Albert. Prince Albert was a very clever man. He always told Queen Victoria's courtiers how to do their work. He was very unpopular with them, and he was even more unpopular because he always was right. He was very clever. Anyway, he made certain changes to the library because when King William IV asked Wyatville, the architect, to build this library, he and the king were very neat people, but they were not bibliophiles. And so one of the things they'd done is they'd made the shelves just to be neat, fairly uniform. And so the books were ordered not by subject, but by size. And quite rightly, Prince Albert said, this will have to be rearranged. The other thing he said, we need more space in this library. So look, there's a gap between here and here, so more bookshelves were added. But just before I come to the modern day, I'd like to mention that this room was first created in the castle, actually in the 1580s, by Queen Elizabeth I. You may know that Queen Elizabeth I was a very active lady, both mentally and physically. She liked to take her exercise as much as possible outside, but she got increasingly fed up with the bad weather. And so in 1583, she decided to build this room, which was then known, you may have heard this expression, a walking gallery. In fact, what we're really looking at is the first gymnasium in Windsor Castle. This is where Queen Elizabeth I took her exercise. There was nothing in it except for a very handsome, no bookcases at all. Those were added in the 1830s. And so the only thing today that is from 1583 is that very handsome fireplace. I don't know if you can just see, there is a bust of Queen Elizabeth I just there. But anyway, let's mention again that this is the basis of the present library, and therefore I'd like to show you now what the library looks like today from almost this exact spot. So there we have it. Do you remember I mentioned that Prince Albert asked for more bookshelves to be put up there? There they are. And there is Queen Elizabeth I's fireplace, mantelpiece. But by some miracle, she has managed to jump from the fireplace onto this bookcase just here. So that is, and I apologize that she's got her back to us, but in fact it's very suitable. She's looking down her own gallery, and it's still, we still call this Queen Elizabeth I's gallery. One or two things about this picture, just to show you. One is of some very distinctive ivory and ebony furniture. I don't know if you can see that right in the foreground here. There's also a table here, chair. That furniture came from a house that I bet you've heard of. King George IV, when he was Prince of Wales and Prince Regent, lived in a house that was spectacular. Any bids for that? Thank you very much. I knew I could depend on you. Carlton House, precisely so. Carlton House was his amazing London residence. When he became king, he sold it, and it was pulled down. And in Carlton House, there was a small library. In that library, there was all that ivory and ebony furniture. So eventually, it came very suitably to Windsor Castle. Another thing, just to mention very briefly, is that on one of the tables there is a book. I'm only indicating under a glass case. That book is the second most valuable book in the Royal Library, and I'm going to come to it in a minute or two's time. But in the meantime, let us walk down Queen Elizabeth I's gallery and through that entrance just there and go down four steps into the second room of the library, which looks like this. And there are the four steps, and that is Queen Elizabeth's gallery here. We've come down here. Now, this room dates from a different period. This dates from the 1490s, when it was built by King Henry VII, again, not as a library, but actually as a bedroom for his wife, Queen Elizabeth of York. So this was a bedroom, but it was converted into a library in the 1833. Again, dear old Prince Albert got hold of it, and he said, we need far more book space. Let us put a gallery right round the room, so there it is, and therefore put all these new bookshelves here. Also, you can see just some more Carlton House furniture with the ivory and ebony. But what I want to do now is to walk into a little room just through that gap there. It's a very small room, up three steps, and it looks like this. And it's got two names. You can take your pick. It's either called the Queen Anne Closet, and there is Queen Anne just there, but it's usually called the Blenheim Closet. Now, the reason it's called the Blenheim Closet is because in 1704, Queen Anne was sitting in this room with her great friend, the Duchess of Marlborough, when the news of the victory of the Battle of Blenheim arrived. That's why it's called the Blenheim Closet. And indeed, the whole story is that the Duke of Marlborough, of course, had won the battle. He had sent, I don't know if any of you know where the battlefield of Blenheim is. It's rather obscure. It's between Munich and Stuttgart in southern Germany. And so the Duke of Marlborough was sitting on the battlefield, well, sitting on his horse on the battlefield at the Battle of Blenheim, having won it. He decided that he had to get news of the victory to Queen Anne as soon as possible. He hadn't got his laptop on him, and so what happened was that he wrote a note. And he wrote a note, and we've got a facsimile of that note on the wall just there. And what he did, he wrote the note and he gave it to the officer sitting on his horse next to him, a man called Colonel Park, who probably regretted being in that position because then he was asked to ride from Blenheim to Windsor Castle. The next rather specialist question for you is, how long does it take a man a man on a horse to get from Munich to Windsor? The answer, I would be surprised, is 12 days. 12 days. So arguably, and by the way, we've got a picture of Colonel Park. That's Colonel Park just there. And so arguably, he got to Windsor, therefore, the 13th of August was the battle. So the 25th of August, a very exhausted Colonel Park arrives in this room, hands over this letter. The letter is not to the Queen, it's to his wife, the Duchess of Marlborough, who is the great friend of the Queen. And the letter says, and I think I've got it almost verbatim, please give my duty to the Queen and tell her that her army has had a glorious victory. I have two French generals in captivity in my coach, and I will send a letter more at large in a few days' time. So this was just a very quick note to report what we call in England an away win. Do you call it that? Anyway, that's what he did. And so so this note arrived, and that's why it's called the Blenheim Closet. Now, and next question, please. Have any of you been to Blenheim Palace? Hooray, excellent. For those of you who haven't, Blenheim Palace was built by the Duke of Marlborough after the Battle of Blenheim. What happened was that Queen Anne and the government were so pleased with the Duke for winning the battle that they gave him an estate called the Woodstock Estate, which is just north of Oxford. It had been a royal estate, and it was given to him, and he built Blenheim Palace on it. However, because it had been a royal estate, it could not be given to him freehold, and so he had to pay a small annual rent, sometimes known as a quit rent or a peppercorn rent. You may have heard the expression. I don't know if any of those who went to Blenheim Palace remember what that rent is. No reason you should, really. I can tell you what it was. It was one French flag per year. And so what you're looking at here is 2 years' rent for Blenheim Palace. And the present Duke of Marlborough still has to give the present Queen one French flag per year. So at Windsor, we've got an inordinate quantity of French flags. So if anybody's got imaginative ideas what to do with French, anyway, there are a lot of them. So now what I'd like to do is to go to the third room of the library, just to go back one step. In other words, we've come through that room, we've walked through here, we're now going to walk through a door just here into the third room of the Royal Library. This was built again in a different period. It was built in the 1670s by someone I'd like you to identify for me. Any bids? King Charles II, okay, I'll tell you, yes. King Charles II, well done. King Charles II, you may recall, and I better do this, King Charles II, his father, King Charles I, you may recall, had a spot of bother with somebody called Oliver Cromwell, yes. So he, sadly, and what happened to King Charles I in 1614? Yes, the answer to a lot of the questions is this, I have to admit. Anyway, so King Charles II came to the throne, was restored to the throne in 1660, and he decided that he wanted to show know that the monarchy was back in business, so he made huge changes to Windsor Castle in the 1660s and 1670s, including some amazing decorations. This, by the way, is his coronation portrait by an artist called J.M. Wright, which was done in 1661. But here is an example of one of the rooms he created. He employed, I don't know if I get any nods for an Italian artist called Antonio Verrio. Yes, a nod, yes. Antonio Verrio came and decorated the ceilings of 13 of these rooms, absolutely brilliantly. So we've come through this door here, into here, and this is one of Charles II's decorated rooms. I don't know if you know a bit about Charles II's character. It wasn't all absolutely plain sailing, I have to admit. And one of his great, I don't say a weakness, perhaps it was a strength, he loved ladies, basically. And you may know that he was so keen on, anyway, I won't go into the details, but he decided to ask a prominent painter of the day to do paintings of all his girlfriends. And a man called Sir Peter Lely, yes, nods for Sir Peter Lely. Anyway, Peter Lely was asked by Charles II to do paintings of all his girlfriends. And here they are. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I think there were 14 at the last count. They were known in those days as the Windsor Beauties because they all hung in this room. If you want to see them today and go to Hampton Court Palace, there they all are, still together at Hampton Court Palace. But now here's the downside of Charles II's character. In those days, this room was Charles II's wife's bedroom. Which I think is not a little bit unsporting, do you think? Anyway, there we are. And the next question, as you will get, Charles II's wife was Catherine of Braganza. She was Catherine of Braganza, a Portuguese lady, I think a delightful lady. In fact, let's have a look at her. There she is. This, by the way, is a miniature painting and therefore is only about 3 inches high. It was by a man called, any nods for Samuel Cooper? He was the best miniature painter of the day. In fact, strictly speaking, he wasn't a miniature painter because he's quite a big man, but he was a painter. He was a painter in miniature. If I say that and get no reaction, I'm really worried. Anyway, he painted this and many other royal images, and this, I think, shows a delightful lady. And she, of course, knew the situation, but she had to sleep in a room with the, so to speak, the competition on the wall. But I think she's a wonderful lady. But this room is converted into the present first room of the library simply by knocking this wall down, doubling the size of the room, I'm afraid removing the ceiling or changing it, and so what it looks like today is this, which is not nearly so dramatic as the one before. The ceiling has gone, but you do see in this room a couple of things that I'd like to point out. Do you remember that I said that Prince Albert wanted this balcony to be put in the previous room? That went continuation from the previous room. You can also see some Carlton House furniture here, the ivory and ebony. This whole bookcase is made of ivory and ebony from Carlton House. And can anybody at the front identify for me what that is there? That's another year's rent for Blenheim Palace, exactly so. I don't know if those of you at the front can just see, next to it is another French flag. This time it's a tricolour. I won't ask you why it's changed, but anyway, there we are. Something happened, if you can identify for me, please, something dramatic that happened in Europe in 1815. A bit of a battle. Battle of Waterloo, I think we're agreed. Thank you, I'll take that. The Battle of Waterloo. After that battle, the Prince Regent, the future George IV, was so pleased with the Duke of Wellington that he gave him an estate on which he built a house called Stratfield Say. Anybody been to Stratfield Say? Anyway, it's a handsome house. It was on royal property. He couldn't be given him it outright. What do you think he had to pay as an annual rent? Absolutely, a French flag. The present Duke of Wellington still has to give one French, and so we've got even more French flags. Now, another couple of things to mention about this room. One is that is the door there through which the present Queen enters when she brings her dinner guests into the library. And these three tables are where we put out the items, the personal items for each guest. Just before I go there, though, I'd just like to point out one other thing, and that is there is a display unit just there that can display about 36 Old Master drawings and watercolours. Some of you may know that the Royal Library at Windsor Castle is best known nationally and internationally, not for its books, which are not actually that important, but for its Old Master drawings and watercolours. Those are probably one of the best such collections in the world, including, for instance, 600 drawings by Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo's, Raphael's, Holbein's, anyway, I'll come to those later. But those Old Master drawings are kept below in a special room called the Print Room, which is on the floor below here. The Queen does not take her guests down there, so that unit enables the Queen to show her guests some of her best Old Master drawings. And I'll be showing you one or two of them in a minute. But just before that, just on one side of this door, on the wall, is a gold clock, which you can't see there, but I'm going to be showing you that gold clock in a couple of minutes. But just before that, let me show you the Queen in action in the Royal Library after one of those dinner parties. Here she is. So there she is. She's showing the items on the table here to two of her guests. This picture, by the way, was taken in the 1990s. These are private dinner parties. There was never a photographer there. In this year, a television film was being made about a year in the life of the Queen. So there was a television. This is from a television program. And in England, people know who those two gentlemen are. One was the leader, the Labour leader of the opposition, called. Thank you. Gosh, you're very well informed. Neil Kinnock. That's Neil Kinnock. And this is a Conservative minister, a government minister. Very close. It's Kenneth Baker, in fact. Kenneth Baker? Anyway, absolutely right. It could have been Howe. Anyway, that was. So there is the Queen showing the guests the items. What would happen is I would send a brief note to the Queen 2 days before the dinner party saying what we'd got out for whom, so she had a rough idea what she was showing them. Now, what you're looking at here is by far the most valuable book in the Royal Library. It was collected by my hero, King George III. He bought it in Germany in 1804. He immediately, by the way, had it rebound so that he could put his own initials on the front. And so there are G3R, the royal cipher. And for those of you who read Latin, I don't have to tell you what it is, but I'll just tell you in any case. It's a book of psalms, codex, a book, Psalmorum, of Psalms. It's made in a place called Moguntiae, which is the Latin word. Has anybody heard of the German city of Mainz? Yes, nods for Mainz. It was made in Mainz. Even more important was the year. Can you see the year? 1457. 1457. Some of you will know why that's important. Let's just have a look inside, though. There it is. Now, the reason it's important is because there was something. I bet you a lot of people will nod if I said, have you heard of the Gutenberg Bible? A lot of nods for the Gutenberg Bible. Just to remind you, the Gutenberg Bible was the first book ever printed with a new invention of movable metal type. In other words, printing as we know it today. It was invented by Johann Gutenberg. The Gutenberg Bible was produced in the city of Mainz by Gutenberg 3 years before this book was printed. This is the second book ever printed. So it is incredibly important. In fact, it's rarer than the Gutenberg Bible because there are 48 copies of the Gutenberg Bible left in existence, only 9 of these. So it's far more important. In fact, King George III's library did have a Gutenberg Bible in it, but it was given to the British Museum, so you can now see it in the British Library. So we lost it. But anyway, this is a pretty spectacular second best. Now, let's go on now to this book. This is the book I showed you on that table in Queen Elizabeth I's gallery, and it's called an illuminated manuscript. It's before the invention of printing, and it was made in Paris in the 1420s, and it was illustrated by 3 of the best artists of the period in watercolour. There are over 60 of these watercolours in the painting. The book is called the Sobieski Book of Hours. A Book of Hours, you probably know, is a devotional book to tell you what prayers you should be saying every day, every hour, every month. Just what. And in it, there are some illustrations that are spectacular. In fact, as well as the illustrations are the borders. Each one of these is unique and so is brilliant. This is manuscript, not printing. So this is in the 1420s. It took about 5 years to create. Let's see the detail here. That is the nativity scene. It's called the Sobieski Book of Hours because it used to belong to somebody called Jan Sobieski. I don't know if he was the king of Poland in the 17th century. He had it, and it came into the British Royal Collection via King George IV, who was acquired it from one of Sobieski's heirs. So let's go on to another manuscript. This is, again, a unique picture of King Henry VIII in his parliament. This is in the House of Lords. The year is 1523. And there is Henry VIII. And exactly as happens today in England, with when the monarch comes to parliament, the meeting is held in the House of Lords, but the House of Commons is allowed to come to listen from what's called the bar of the House, which is this bar here, led by the Speaker of the House of Commons, just there. So this is the House of Lords. Have you heard of an expression called a woolsack? Anyway, a woolsack are these extremely uncomfortable things that they were sitting on here. And the House of Lords is on the left-hand side, where the what were called the spiritual lords, the bishops and the abbots behind them. On the right-hand side are what are called the temporal lords, the dukes, earls, viscounts, marquesses. And there is the king. What I'd like to ask you about is I'm going to identify three other characters in this picture. You'll know two of them, possibly not the third. The first one is the Lord Chancellor of the day. We're talking about 1523. You may not recognize him. There he is, just there. But your clue is that his coat of arms has a cardinal's hat. Yes, we've got him, his Cardinal Wolsey. Next to him is the Archbishop of Canterbury with a mitre on his thing. Now, if you got him, I would be very pleased. Anyway, this man was called William Wareham or Wareham. Anyway, he was the Archbishop. Good story about William Wareham. 2 years after this, in 1525, he asked Henry VIII if he could retire on health grounds. William Wareham was absolutely healthy, nothing wrong with him at all, except that he disagreed with Henry VIII on his divorce policy from Catherine of Aragon, and therefore he knew that if he remained as Archbishop, he would have a very serious health problem. You have it, he would be executed. And so he was allowed to retire and lived, I'm glad to report, to a great old age. Anyway, so that's the second man. The third man, you will know who he is when I give you a hint or two. The first hint, and I would really forgive you if you did not recognize him for his back view, that is the Speaker. Anybody? No, I think that's a bit of a specialist. That is the back view of the Speaker. Now, second clue, I'm going to give you three clues. The second clue is that in 1529, you may recall that Cardinal Wolsey fell out of favor. So there's Cardinal Wolsey, fell out of favor with Henry VIII, and the Speaker of the House of Commons became Lord Chancellor. That's the second clue. The third clue is... Yes? Yes, Cromwell is a good guess, but in fact it's this gentleman. Yes? You see who he is? We've got him now. It's Sir Thomas More. Yes? Sir Thomas More. In fact, you can just see it. Thomas More, Lord Chancellor, up here. Now, next question, please, and I'm more confident with this one. Who painted this watercolour? We're all agreed. I sometimes score the left against the right, by the way. I think we got all of you there. Okay, this is indeed by Holbein. Now, Holbein came over from the continent to England in 1526, and he brought with him a letter from his friend Erasmus. Any nods for Erasmus? I hope so. Erasmus. Erasmus wrote a letter to his friend, Thomas More, to say, please look after my friend Holbein. That's exactly what happened. Holbein lived with Thomas More for those first 2 years, 1526 to 1528. During that time, he did a number of sketches, drawings, watercolours, and indeed oil paintings of Thomas More. This was a preparatory drawing for an oil painting. The oil painting, sadly, is not in the Royal Collection. It's in a small collection in New York, which you will know, which you will tell me about. Doug will tell me. It's called the Frick. Thank you very much. It's called the Frick Collection, and it looks like this. In fact, a lot of art historians say that the drawing is more interesting than the oil painting in the sense that in the painting, Holbein was concentrating on the robes of office, the chains of office, whereas in the drawing, he was looking at the character of Thomas More, who, as you probably know, was a very clever man indeed. However, he had the problem of disagreeing also with Henry VIII, you recall? Now, next question, please. What happened to Thomas More in 1535? The usual answer, he was executed, exactly. But we do have this copy of his head in the Royal Collection. And indeed, we have 80 Holbein drawings in the Royal Collection because Holbein went back to the continent. He came back to England in 1532, stayed as court painter to Henry VIII, and when he died, rather young, in 1543, Henry VIII scooped up all the drawings from Holbein's studio and added them to the Royal Collection. So we've got 80 of these fantastic drawings. Another item in the library we have that dates from Henry VIII's period is this book written by Henry VIII himself. It's more of a pamphlet than a book. This is Henry VIII's own copy. That is Henry VIII's signature, just there. And this book, he wrote it in Latin in 1521. Now, I'm sure I get some nods for somebody called Martin Luther. Yes, hooray. Martin Luther, you may remember, Martin Luther was making himself a little bit unpopular with the Pope at that time. In fact, the Pope had just excommunicated him. And Henry VIII didn't like Luther either, and so wrote this book, which was a diatribe against Martin Luther. And Henry VIII sent a top copy of this to Rome, to the Pope. The Pope was so pleased with Henry VIII for having written this pamphlet that he gave Henry VIII the title Defender of the Faith. I don't know if you've heard of that title, but Defender of the Faith is that was a title originated from this time. And in fact, what has happened is that what the Pope... do you remember that there was a slight disagreement between Henry VIII and the Pope? Yes? A little bit of a disagreement. In fact, quite a serious disagreement. And Henry VIII broke away from the Church of Rome. However, what happened was that the Pope kept the book, but we kept the title. Yes? Because the present queen is still called Defender of the Faith. And it's all because of this book. If you go to Rome, go to the Vatican, go to the Vatican Library, it's still there. Now, this is... excuse me. This is the clock that I mentioned was just on the wall next to the door through which the queen enters the library. This gold clock was a wedding present from King Henry VIII to Anne Boleyn when they got married in 1533. The clock still works. But you may remember that Anne Boleyn herself did not work for very long. Well, she didn't work for very long. What happened to her in 1536? Again, same art, exactly, okay. Yes, she was executed. However, and what happened was the clock went out of the Royal Collection, and it went into the collection of someone, again, any nods for somebody called Horace Walpole? Lot of nods. Horace Walpole, Strawberry Hill, amazing house. Horace Walpole got it. When he died, Walpole died, it was bought by Queen Victoria and brought back into the Royal Collection. Now, I don't know of those present, you might or might not remember that I did show you this 2.5 years ago. Because, yes, you are some nods, hooray. Should I go on or should I? For those of you who haven't, I can't resist. This is from my favourite book in the Royal Library at Windsor, which generated from a gentleman coming to see me who is a professor, an American professor of Islamic art, who had been studying Indian Mughal painting for 35 years, a man called Milo Beach. He comes to see me in 1991 and he says, "Do you know that you've got the best Mughal paintings in the world in your library?" He's a world expert on Mughal paintings. To my shame, but not to my surprise, I had absolutely no idea. But I'm afraid I wasn't prepared to admit that to him. And so I'm afraid what I did is I bluffed and I said, "Well, of course, but do tell me more." And this lovely man told me a great deal more. You may remember from 2.5 years ago, but I don't suppose you do. He said that there are 44 paintings in this book, which is called the Padshah Nama, which is the Persian word for the chronicle of the king of the world. The king of the world that we're talking about is the Indian Mughal Emperor Shah Jahan, who built the Taj Mahal, exactly. There is Shah Jahan, there. This is one of those 44 paintings. And those, how many of you have been to the Taj Mahal? A few, I hope, yes. Anyway, what happened was that this painting was painted the year after the Taj Mahal was started to be built. The Taj was started in 1632, this was 1633, and this painting was also in the same city that the Taj was being built, in a city called Agra, which you've probably heard of. And this is, in fact, what's happening here is an elephant. Only emperors were allowed to stage elephant fights, and so it's a very important occasion. And the text of the manuscript tells us exactly what's happening. I don't know if from 2.5 years ago any of you remember the name of the elephant. I think that would be rather a difficult one. Anyway, this elephant is called Sudaka. Sudaka is meant to be fighting Surat Sundar, has obviously got a bit bored, and has decided to have a run for the emperor. Now, this is a very dangerous situation. The emperor might get killed. But the text says that, in fact, it gave an opportunity for one of Shah Jahan's four sons to show princely valour. This is what princes love to do in a crisis, to show their bravery. And so this is the third son, a very nasty bloke called Prince Aurangzeb. I mean, he eventually overthrew his father. He's only 15 here. This is Prince Aurangzeb, age 15. And the text says the brave Prince Aurangzeb stopped the charging elephant with his spear. I don't know if at your back you can just see his spear here. Do you think it's a bit unlikely? So do I. But why it's my favourite picture, which you may faintly recall from 2.5 years ago, is because there is something incredibly useful for all of us in it, you may recall, and that is next time you find yourself on a runaway elephant, I can tell you how to stop it. And you will be extremely grateful. Just to remind you, in case you haven't remembered this, now, next question, what is the name of the man who is meant to be in control of an elephant? He's called the... The Mahout is there. And in this case, he's not in control at all, sadly. But what you probably didn't know is that an elephant has two braking systems, a foot brake and a hand brake. Bet you didn't know that. And the foot brake, which has been applied ineffectively, is a log of wood just there, attached to a rope, attached to the elephant's ankle, on the principle that the rope will get snarled round his feet and ankles and trip him and stop him. It hasn't. And very culpably, the Mahout has not applied the handbrake. I hope you, even at the back, I hope you may be able to... The handbrake is a piece of red cloth which is just there with weights on the end. What he should have done is thrown that cloth over the head of the elephant, particularly over the eyes, on the principle that if he can't see where he's going, he will stop. So next time you're on the runaway elephant, all you have to do is lean forward and whisper in the Mahout's ear, apply the handbrake. It's as easy as that. And I can't resist, I don't know if I told you this 2.5 years ago, but I showed this probably over 2 years ago, and a gentleman came up to me afterwards and he said, you do know that those male elephants are in season, they're in must. And I said, well, no, I didn't, do tell me. And he said, and by the way, when I showed this in Adelaide, and a lady put her hand up and said, absolutely. Anyway, the explanation is male elephants, perhaps they've got a lot of elephants in Adelaide, but anyway, male elephants have glands on their cheekbones just here and here, and when they're in season, in must, they secrete a fluid down their cheek. And I don't know if you can see, the gland is just there. Can you see that stripe? If you see that stripe on an elephant's cheek, run, is the answer. Let's go on. This is a bit more bookish. This is the last letter which King Charles I wrote before his execution on the 30th of January, 1649. And that is his signature. And the letter, which was dictated, was rather charmingly, it was a reference for a man called Thomas Herbert. And you can see Thomas Herbert's name just there. And Thomas Herbert had been assigned to him as a gentleman in waiting in the 4 weeks before his execution. 2 days before the execution, very charmingly, Charles I realized that it might be difficult for Thomas Herbert to get a job after the execution because of his association with the disgraced king. So he wrote this letter, this reference saying, Herbert did not choose to be my gentleman in waiting. He's a decent man. Please look upon him kindly for a job, which I think is charming. I haven't got time to explain why that says 1648, but afterwards, if anybody's interested, I'll tell you. Now, in the Royal Library also, we have this shirt, which was the overshirt in which King Charles I was executed. And I've got a quote from Charles I as to why he's wearing it. You may remember that he was executed on the 30th of January, which is very hot here, but it's very cold in London. And you remember he was executed at the Banqueting House in London? You probably know. Anyway, it was very cold. And so, and I'm quoting Charles I here, he said, "Let me have on a shirt more than ordinary, lest I should shiver from cold, and some people may think I shiver from fear. I fear not death, I believe in God." Anyway, that was the background. So he had this shirt made, he wore it as an overshirt, and was executed in it. And so it's a very important garment. I'm sure you're very ghoulishly looking for bloodstains, are you? I thought you might be. In fact, I think it was sent to the cleaners quite soon after the execution. In fact, you can't see any... But it is a very handsome shirt. There's lovely lace work in the sleeves and in the cuffs. It does have one design feature that I think is quite interesting that perhaps you might have included in a shirt if you were going to be executed in it, and that was that it had a very wide neck fitting. There. I think, anyway, I think it's a very important. Let's go on. What I'd like to do very briefly is to pick from the shelves of the library three books which are in themselves not that interesting, but they're made interesting from what is written in the flyleaf. And the three books that I'm taking, now I don't know if, are there any people of Scottish origin here? I have to be careful. Yes, I thought there might be. Sir Walter Scott is not my favourite author. He goes on a bit, but he's a good author. Anyway, there we are. And we have a set of his novels in the Royal Library. There are 35 in the set. And here is one of them. It's number 25, I think. Yes, number 25. These are Scott's novels. This one is called Peveril of the Peak, produced in Edinburgh in 1824. I'm going to take that off the shelf and look inside the flyleaf. Then I'm going to take some of Benjamin Disraeli's novels here. There are four volumes of them. And then I'm going to take a biography of the Duke of Marlborough, who we were talking about, written by his family member, Sir Winston Churchill. In 1933. So first of all, let's look inside that Walter Scott novel. Now, anybody who has been to the Royal Archives at Windsor will immediately recognise the handwriting, but I wouldn't expect you to know it. This is by Queen Victoria, and Queen Victoria writes in this book, and for those of you at the back, I'll read what Queen Victoria writes here. She says, "This book was read up to the mark in page 81, and the mark is still there." Some of you may know what I mean by mourning paper. It has a black edge when somebody's died. There was a piece of mourning paper. "To my beloved husband, Prince Albert, during his fatal illness and within 3 days of its terrible termination, December the 14th, 1861. Some of you may remember that poor old Prince Albert died only age 42 of typhoid at Windsor Castle. 3 days before that, this book was being read to him. Very sad indeed. I'm not sure that he died. Perhaps typhoid. I mustn't be. Anyway, here we have a book. Benjamin Disraeli wrote a large number of novels, and he gave a set of them to Queen Victoria. How many of you saw a very good film called Mrs. Brown? Yes, about Queen Victoria. It included a very good part played by an actor called Anthony Scher of Benjamin Disraeli. And this is therefore, and do you remember Benjamin Disraeli was brilliant at flattering Queen Victoria? Queen Victoria loved it. And Benjamin Disraeli did it very well. So this is an example of Benjamin Disraeli writing this foreword, this to Queen Victoria in 1868. "Mr. Disraeli, with his humble duty to Your Majesty, Your Majesty once deigned to say Your Majesty would not refuse to accept some volumes which he once wrote. The edition is not worthy of Your Majesty, but it is the only complete one now to be obtained." And then he starts to go a bit over the top, as he usually did, "and it is humbly offered..." Do you know who I mean by Uriah Heep? Anyway... "it is humbly offered, not as he hopes from the vanity of an author," and then it gets even worse, "but that he should not appear indifferent or insensible to the condescension that was graciously expressed." Do you see what I mean? It's a little bit over the top. Queen Victoria loved it, so that was fine. Now, this finally is that book, the biography of the Duke of Marlborough by Sir Winston Churchill, written in 1933. Winston Churchill sent this copy to King George V, and this is, for those of you at the back, I think we probably all agree that Winston Churchill was a great master of words, whether spoken or written, and this is, I think, a very good example of Churchill's crisp prose. And he says, "This is the story of how a wise princess and queen," that's Queen Anne, whose bust we saw just now, "gave her trust and friendship to an invincible commander, and thereby," that's of course Marlborough, "and thereby raised the power and fame of England to a height never before known and never since lost," this was 1933, "and is submitted in loyal duty to a sovereign," that's King George V, "under whom our country has come through perils even more grievous," First World War, "with no less honour," by the author Winston Spencer Churchill, 1933. I just think that's a lovely example of Churchillian prose. Now, I didn't want to let you go before showing you one or two old master drawings. Do you remember I said there were 600 drawings by Leonardo da Vinci? I'm just going to show you this one. It's this horse drawings of horses. In the 1490s, Leonardo was working for the Duke of Milan, and he was asked by the... And by the way, he wasn't employed as an artist to start with. He was employed as a military engineer and a hydraulic engineer. But soon, the Duke found that he could do almost anything. For instance, I wonder if you knew that he designed ladies' dresses for dances? Very versatile. Anyway, the Duke said to him, would he make an equestrian statue of the late Duke of Milan, the Duke's father? Leonardo said, of course. He started by producing 25 preparatory drawings. This is one of them. Then Leonardo produced a clay model of the equestrian statue, but unfortunately, before he could produce the eventual bronze statue, the French were impolite enough to invade Milan in 1499. Leonardo had to escape back to his native Florence, taking with him all his drawings, including these 25 of horses. Now, again, this, by the way, is, I should have mentioned the scale, is about an A4 piece of vellum, not big. This is by another old master, and some of you will be able to tell me who did it. Doug, I'm sure, would, if he hadn't got the flu. This is by somebody called Michelangelo. Yes, Michelangelo. In the Royal Collection, we've got 22 drawings by Michelangelo, five of them, including this one collected by George III. Now, this was done in 1530. I like to know how old people are. Michelangelo was 55 years. He lived to a ripe old age. But some of you may know that Michelangelo produced two sorts of drawings. One of them were called preparatory drawings for his sculptures and his altarpieces. The other sort, which this is one, are called presentation drawings. They were fully worked up drawings or watercolours, which he gave as presents to his friends, relations, important people. And the subject of this is obviously archers shooting at a target. And I hope that you can just see, there's the target. You can see an arrow or two. But if I could ask you, please, the next question, what is missing from this picture of archers? You answer the bows, exactly what I wanted you to say. However, I have to mention to you that about 3 weeks ago, I asked an audience in Australia, and a lady at the front said, the clothes. And I gave her a lot of points, but what I know what I wanted you to say was the bows. And you can see exactly where the bows should be. One, two, three, four. The reason they're not there, I can think of two reasons. The first was that Michelangelo was passionately uninterested in bows as such. They didn't do it for him at all. But a more serious reason was that if he had included them, they would have totally spoiled his composition. Because as I'm sure you know, what Michelangelo was most interested in and best at doing was depicting human anatomy, whether it was in stone, in his sculptures, or in drawings, as here. So what we actually have here is one of Michelangelo's finest anatomical drawings. And it was a very great addition. I'm glad to say, however, that Michelangelo wasn't without a sense of humour. I don't know if some of you can see on the bottom left-hand side, there are two cupids, or putti. One of them's here, one of them's there. And what they're doing, I don't know if you can see at the back, what they're doing is lighting a fire underneath the archers here. I have to be careful with my pointer. I think that might have been a bit uncomfortable for them in their position. And on the right-hand bottom side, you can see another Cupid or Pato who is clearly bored with the whole thing and is sound asleep. And he's got a charming wing behind him here. He actually has a bow here. And somebody the other day pointed out to me, there's another bow up there. Somebody thought that Michelangelo couldn't do bows, but he could, but he just included them where he wanted. Now, here again, some people may know who this is by. This is by another of the three top old master drawers. We've seen Leonardo, we've seen Michelangelo, therefore this is by, thank you, by Raphael. Now, this again, it's on an A4 piece of paper or vellum. This, some of you may know, I assume some of you have been to Rome, and therefore some of you have been into the Vatican, you've been to the Sistine Chapel. Next to the Sistine Chapel, there are four rooms called the Stanze. I get nods for this, good. One of them is called the Stanza della Signatura. If you look at the ceiling of that room, you will see a beautiful Raphael painting of the Muse of Poetry. This is his preparatory drawing for that ceiling painting. In 1508, when Raphael was only 27 years old, he was commissioned by the then Pope to do the decoration of those four rooms, all the ceilings, all the walls. Absolutely beautiful, and so this is one of his finest preparatory drawings. Now, you've been a very polite audience, thank you. Sometimes in America, when Diana and I are visiting, a member of the audience will just put his hand up and say, "How much is that worth?" And it's a good question, but it's not easy to answer because Raphael drawings don't come up very often. But about 2 years ago, a Raphael drawing did come up, which was smaller than this, but it was for the same commission. It was just the head and shoulders of the Muse of Poetry. It came up in Christie's in London. It was sold for £29.2 million. This is minimum 35. Anyway, it's quite extraordinary. So it is very valuable, but there it is. Now, I'd said that there were 30,000 old master drawings and watercolours in the Royal Collection. Half of them were collected by George III, which is a phenomenal achievement. I'm sometimes asked, how on earth did he do it? The answer is quite simple. He sent one of my predecessors, his librarian, a man called Richard Dalton, on four buying expeditions to Italy, first in the 1750s when he was still Prince of Wales, twice in the 1760s and again in the 1770s. Richard Dalton brought back thousands of drawings. And a few years ago in the Royal Library, totally by chance, I came across a print of Richard Dalton, my predecessor, and to my absolute amazement, he looked almost identical to myself. There he is. I should not make fun of Richard Dalton. He did a fantastic job, far better than me. But anyway, I think the pastor got the better of him. Anyway, now here's another old master. This is where are we now? In Venice, in St. Mark's Square. And I probably don't have to tell you who did it. The best painter in Venice in the 18th century was... Thank you, I've got Canaletto. I'll accept Canaletto from there. Thank you. This is by Canaletto. What happened was that in 1762, George III was lucky enough to buy a huge number of Canaletto paintings from the British consul in Venice, a man called Joseph Smith, which I mentioned yesterday. And Joseph Smith had gone to Venice in the early 18th century. He stayed there for the rest of his life. He became a publisher, a book dealer, an art dealer, a banker. And he collected a huge collection of Canalettos. In 1762, he had to sell the lot because he had economic problems. George III bought the lot. And we've got 140 of these watercolours by Canaletto and almost 50 oil paintings. All came into the Royal Collection then. And how many of you have been to, I'm sure some of you have been to Venice. Have you been to a very famous cafe? Yes. Called? Florian's, yes, exactly right, called Florian's. Very expensive, don't go there. But in fact, that was opened in 1720 and very soon became very infamous because a number of years later, an Italian gentleman who went there, but why it was infamous, because it was the only cafe in Venice at that time that unaccompanied ladies were allowed to go into. So this Italian gentleman in the 1740s was called... Thank you, and well, that would have suited too. Actually, I'll accept Caravaggio. It was actually... Casanova. Yeah, it was Casanova. Anyway, he went there for more than the coffee, it was thought. When you last went to Venice, how many monkeys did you see in St. Mark's Square? And I don't know if you can see two more there. And another. Anyway, there we go. Let's go on quickly. Now, I'm going to end with the fire at Windsor in 1992. because after the fire, the present Queen commissioned a very good watercolour artist called Alexander Cresswell to do 10 watercolours of the fire-damaged Windsor Castle. When he'd finished them, this, by the way, is St George's Hall, the big banqueting hall at Windsor. When he'd finished them, he brought them to Windsor to show to the Queen. Princess Margaret, by chance, was there. And Princess Margaret said to the artist, Cresswell, "It's a horrible subject, but in some way you have made it look rather appealing. How do you explain that?" Cresswell answered, without actually thinking, he said to Princess Margaret, "Well, ma'am, it's very seldom that this room is top lit." You can see what he meant. Because, as I'm sure you know, artists love the effect of light coming into a room. And Cresswell, who lives in a place called Guildford, which is south of Windsor, he used to phone me up. I used to have to organise his visits. He would say to me, it's sunny in Guildford. Is it sunny in Windsor?" He would only come if the sun was there to have this effect. Just to remind you what this room looked like before the fire, that's what it looked like. I just ask you this is a banquet the Queen gives for in 1991 for, I think, 164 people. Just to notice one thing about the room, and that is the flat ceiling. What happened was that 9 of these huge rooms were destroyed by the fire. There was a big debate whether they should be restored exactly as they were or changed. There was a compromise. 4 of the rooms were changed, and this room was going to be changed. And I don't know what you do in Australia if changes are suggested. The first thing we do in England is form a committee. Yes, that's what we all... Anyway, the chairman of this committee was a member of the royal family interested in architecture, Prince of Wales. In 1995, the present Prince of Wales comes to the Royal Library. We show him a print of what St George's Hall, this hall, looked like in the 1360s when it was made by King Edward III as a banqueting chamber for his Knights of the Garter, which he founded in 1348, and this is what we showed him. And the Prince of Wales, I think, very wisely said, the new St George's Hall should in some way harp back to this 14th century St George's Hall. And that one point I wanted to point out to you, the flat ceiling of the previous one, look at this steeper ceiling and this hammer beam construction. And therefore, the new St George's Hall looks like this. And as you can see, a higher pitch ceiling and a hammer beam construction. And that hammer beam construction was done as it would have been in the 14th century. No nuts, bolts, nails, screws, nothing like that. It's all what's called green oak, which is unseasoned oak. So, and this, by the way, is by the same watercolour artist, Alexander Cresswell, who was commissioned by the Queen to do another series of watercolours of the restored castle. And this was the first banquet that the Queen gave at the restored castle. This was in December 1997. And so I'm going to finish with what is probably one of the Queen's favourite items in the Royal Library. I often would see her taking her guests to this exercise book to show them it to them. And what it is, some of you might, by now may have worked it out, this is the writing of the present Queen, aged 11. And she had just been to attend her father's coronation, King George VI's coronation, and she was asked by her governess to write a description of the coronation, aged 11. And my favourite bit, for those of you perhaps at the back who can't read it, says, if I can read it from here, "At the end, the service got rather boring." Which she's 11. As it was all prayers. And Granny and I, that's Queen Mary, Granny and I were looking to see how many more pages to the end. and we turned one more, and then I pointed to the word at the bottom of the page, and it said, "Finis." We both smiled at each other and turned back to the service. I just think this is very natural for an 11-year-old. And then this is the end of the thing. It says, "After Papa," that's King George VI, "had passed," this is the end of the service, "we were all shivering because there was a most awful draught coming from somewhere." I showed this for many years without realising where that draught came from. Westminster Abbey, at the end of the service, what do? They open the great west doors. Anyway, there we are. So we were glad to get out of the box. Then we went down the aisle, first a gentleman I did not know, then Margaret, that's Princess Margaret, and myself, and then Granny, that's Queen Mary, and now comes the best part of the coronation. And that is, when we got back to our dressing room, we had some sandwiches, stuffed rolls, orangeade, and lemonade. That's clearly the most important. Anyway, there we are. What I hope I've done for you is to give you that tour of the library that the Queen gives to her guests. I hope it illustrates the point that my... Do you remember my predecessor said that the Queen uses it as a cabaret? This is what she does. She entertains her guests with it. And also, I think it also illustrates a comment made by one gentleman in the late 19th century who was shown around the library at some length. And afterwards, he was asked by someone, well, what do you think of that? And he said it was simply a feast of treasures and curiosities. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much, Oliver. Good evening, everyone. My name is Philip Kent, and I'm the university librarian. Unfortunately, we don't have time for questions, but I think we were all just delighted to sit and listen to everything that Oliver had to say. Thank you so much for your lecture tonight. Your depth of knowledge, together with your friendly, open, yet polished and scholarly style of presentation has captivated us all. And how many people got the questions right? We are very indeed fortunate that you have family members in Melbourne and visit here from time to time. You've kindly shared with us tonight and on previous occasions three different but most engaging presentations. Tonight, we've all felt as if we were truly guests of you and Her Majesty at Windsor Castle. Thanks for sharing this experience with us, and please come back and visit us again when you and Diana are next in Australia. We have a small gift for you to remember us by.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The University Library has been delighted to play a part in hosting Oliver's visit to the university. We share a mutual interest in rich and rare collections and in sharing them with like-minded audiences. For a completely different theme, you are most welcome to our current exhibition titled Protest! In the Lee Scott Gallery on the first floor of the Ballew Library. Opened recently by our alumna, Jermaine Greer, it features items from the university's archives from the social activism era of the 1960s and 70s. In mid-April, we open a new exhibition to celebrate the 75th anniversary of the Granger Museum, and that exhibition will continue in the museum for the rest of the year. In the middle of the year, our rare book exhibition in the Ballew Library will coincide with Rare Book Week and the return of the popular antiquarian book fair in Wilson Hall on the last weekend in July. Please watch the library website to be alerted to these forthcoming public exhibitions and events, which are part of our engagement commitment to you and the community at large. Thank you again very much for coming to this public lecture. You're most welcome to join us again for other quality lectures in this series. Good evening to you all, and thank you again to Oliver.